from KQED.
Here's what's coming up on Forum in our second hour this morning. We'll examine CAL FIRE's recent findings that 12 of the Northern California wildfires last October were caused by PG&E distribution lines and poles. We'll talk about the report and the investigations that are still ongoing. And to listen to past Forum shows and subscribe to our podcast, visit kqed.org/forum. And for the latest updates on our programs and guests, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. State fire officials on Friday shed new light on the causes of the deadly October wildfires in Northern California, and they are blaming PG&E for many of them. 12 of the fires were caused by electrical problems, according to officials.
We've got major damage to a power pole. We're going to need PG&E.
Have power lines down.
Hazardous condition, electrical power lines down.
Power lines arcing, no fire.
A live power line that's rolling over the street right here.
Those were a few of the 911 calls from the firestorm, and the CAL FIRE findings cover the Redwood Fire in Mendocino County, which killed 9 people, and the Atlas Fire in Napa County, which killed 6. But the cause has not yet been announced for the blaze that caused the greatest loss of life and the most extensive property damage, the Tubbs Fire. That fire killed 23 people and destroyed more than 5,000 homes, mostly in Santa Rosa. PG&E put out a statement saying that its program met our state's high standards and pointed the finger at climate change and the longer fire season. We did invite PG&E to join this discussion, but the company declined. Joining us first to talk about the CAL FIRE report is Michael Moeller. He's Deputy Director at CAL FIRE. Michael Moeller, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
I guess the place to begin here is how this investigation was conducted, and give us, if you could, a kind of highlight of what was concluded.
Well, these, in just the fires, we have a total of 12 that we released causes on Friday. We're looking at, these are very, very difficult investigations when you have a fire siege, record fire siege. Hundreds of personnel hours go into this where CAL FIRE law enforcement, our goal is life and fire safety investigations. So our job out there is to determine cause and origin, put those together in a case report, review it, and then make recommendations to the respective district attorney. Attorneys moving forward, but I can tell you these were very difficult, very time-consuming. We don't have an option. We have to be, 100% spot on. These are very methodical, scientific investigations that our law enforcement was out there doing in cooperation with local government and law enforcement agencies.
And they started early. I mean, actually started when the fire started, didn't they begin then?
That absolutely. CAL FIRE investigation was 9,000 fires a year, but on initial dispatch, one of our law enforcement officers is immediately dispatched to the scene or closest to where the first report was, because as you well know, when our firefighters are out there, or depending on weather conditions, evidence of cause and origin can unfortunately be disrupted or I hate to use the term, but actually burn up and go away where we can't determine the cause.
But in this case, most of the cause and most of the culpability points toward PG&E and toward not only power and power lines and failure of electronic equipment, but also mismanagement and real problems with management?
Well, I don't know about as far as management. When we look at these, I mean, we're talking some of these gusts and were record-setting wind gusts. And if you look at, for your listeners, you look at a hurricane in Florida, you're not going to stop those. And unfortunately, regardless if it's PG&E or any utility, at some point you're going to have infrastructure failure. It just can't be 100% prevented. But there are areas where some of our investigations determine that some of them could have been prevented, and that's where, there may be a violation of state law that we in turn carry to the district attorney to make that decision on what route they may go.
CAL FIRE, so what, 8 of the 12 fires PG&E violated state law?
That's what we're looking at right now. That's correct.
And at this point, we have to wait to hear what you have concluded about the Tubbs Fire. When will that be revealed?
You know, we have several fires, including the Tubbs, that are still, you know, an active investigation. Obviously, the Tubbs being one of the largest, you know, there's a lot of work, and it's not uncommon for these fires to take this long to investigate. As far as when, I don't know. Hopefully within the next, you know, few weeks. But again, that's all determined. We will not rush our investigators until they know absolutely, you know, the cause, origin, and what recommendations they may make.
And for those who want to read the report or find out more about it, they can go to the CAL FIRE website, I presume?
That is correct. Ones with no violations being the Redwood, Sulphur, Cherokee, and 37. Those reports are available online on the CAL FIRE website. The others that are referred to the district attorney are not until they determine, again, what they may follow as far as actions.
All right, Michael Mahler, good to have you with us, and thank you so much for the work you've done and for being with us this morning on Forum.
Thanks again for having us.
That's again Michael Mahler, Deputy Director of CAL FIRE. Joining us for the hour here in studio, Marisa Lagos, reporter for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk and co-host of KQED's Political Breakdown podcast. Good morning, Marisa.
Morning, Michael.
And we'll say good morning to Suki Lewis, reporter for KQED. Suki, hi.
Good morning.
And to John Fisk, who joins us by phone, attorney representing the counties of Mendocino, Napa, and Sonoma in their litigation against PG&E. John Fisk, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. And I guess this makes your case all the much stronger?
Well, this confirms what we as lawyers already suspected and found in our own independent investigation. As wildfire litigators, we hire cause and origin experts who also engage in an investigation. And when we see CAL FIRE reports come out that confirm that, it confirms the litigation and the reasoning behind the lawsuits to begin with. There are actually 16 fires in total that have come out from CAL FIRE. So I know you mentioned 12 at the beginning of the show, but on May 25th, a CAL FIRE news release came out showing the first four fires. And last Friday, we had the second set of 12 fires. So in total, there are 16 fires that have been investigated, and a conclusion has been drawn by CAL FIRE that PG&E is the responsible party and that the cause and origin of the fire was PG&E equipment. Of those 16 fires, 11 of them, CAL FIRE found a violation of state law. And of those 16, 11 have been referred to the district attorney. And so far, of the 16 that have been investigated, 16 have been shown to be the cause and origin of PG&E.
Well, as we said earlier, we invited PG&E. They declined. But I'm wondering what you say in response to the response that we've heard from PG&E. And I'm looking at actual announcement that was made by PG&E, where they say the safety of our customers, their families, and the communities we serve is our most important job. The loss of life, homes, and businesses in these extraordinary wildfires is simply heartbreaking, and we remain focused on helping communities recover and rebuild. And based on the information we have so far, we continue to believe our overall programs met our state's high standards.
You know, I think there are a lot of good people that are working at PG&E. There are a lot of brave linemen and good men and women that work with and for PG&E. Unfortunately, I think that PG&E has a corporate history at the executive level of mismanagement of resources and mismanagement of vegetation activities. In one year, they were found to be a six-time felon. In another year, they were found criminally negligent many dozens of times. In another year, they took $77.6 million and redirected it away from public funds towards executive compensation. And here you have a situation where PG&E is saying in news releases, we believe our standards were, you know, at the highest level, when in fact CAL FIRE, which is an independent organization whose sole purpose is to protect the 15 million customers that PG&E serves, has found the exact opposite, that even in 11 of the 16 fires, state law was violated. And we believe, as wildfire litigators on behalf of our clients, we're going to find negligence in the other 5 out of 16. And so you see a situation where a multi-billion dollar corporation that serves Wall Street investors and shareholders, first and foremost, is saying one thing in a news release, but their actions and their history is saying something different in the real world.
Well, if you just joined us, we're talking with John Fisk, attorney who represents a number of counties in their litigation against PG&E. And yet PG&E has said it's all about climate change, years of drought, extreme heat, 129 million dead trees.
Well, the problem with that is that even though climate change is real, and we have no doubt about that, that's not what starts wildfires. And that's specifically not what starts utility-caused wildfires. There are really three or four things only that cause utility-caused wildfires, and they're often interrelated. One is poor vegetation management. Two is poor or no high wind, or what we call power-down policies. And three is what we call recloser policies, and that's the reclosing of a breaker or re-energizing of a line. And so what happens in these cases is we know that high winds, which are predictable, it's predictable weather science, we know these high winds are coming, and we need to be able to prepare for those high winds because of climate change. Even though these winds were high, they were not unforeseeable, they were not unpredictable. And so we need to set policies that power down or de-energize lines in high wind situations, and certainly not re-energize lines once service has been interrupted because of a line down or a pole that has gone down in the middle of a wind event. And in fact, San Diego Gas and Electric, after the 2007 fires, learned a valuable lesson and, to their credit, changed and enhanced their policies. That has been 10 years in the making. This is a 10-year-old lesson that PG&E should have also learned. And in fact, recently in 2017, the Lilac Fire threatened an enormous problem, and SDG&E did decide to power down service for thousands of customers. And so here you see a good example of a utility acting in the way that it should, and an example of a utility acting inadequately or negligently. So if there is good vegetation management, if there are good high wind policies or power down policies, and if there are good policies with regards to re-energizing lines once they've gone down, we believe that the overwhelming majority, if not all of these utility-caused wildfires, are preventable.
Again, we're talking about CAL FIRE's recently announced findings on the causes of the October wildfire. And that's John Fisk, attorney representing the counties of Mendocino, Napa, and Sonoma in their litigation against PG&E. Marisa Lagos and Suki Lewis, our two ACE reporters, are here with us in Studio 2. And Suki, talking about Sonoma, right now there's an internal report that's being presented over there to the Board of Supervisors. Tell us.
Yeah, so this was a review that was done internally. Sonoma County actually asked the California's office, Governor's Office of Emergency Services, to come in and do this review and tell them kind of where they went wrong. And now this is a further kind of deeper look, deeper dive into what went wrong the night of October 8th and into the emergency response in the weeks afterwards. And today, the supervisors are going to hear the review, which kind of found a lot of what we also found in our reporting. We did a deep investigation into the night of the fires, which is that there was kind of improper training. People were not properly trained in how to send out the alerts. So they do have a pretty robust alert system, but a lot of it was not utilized. These wireless emergency alerts that I think a lot of people have heard a lot about at this point were not used. And, there's been changes coming out about that. And also that there kind of was this like gap in communication internally between law enforcement, between emergency management personnel, and also between the supervisors. And so how to kind of make these changes to get a more robust and effective emergency response system within the county. So they're looking at, more training, $1.2 million in staffing positions possibly being added. And they're going to kind of vote on next steps on that today, which I think is a really important step for the county.
And this also dovetails with what the Governor's Office of Emergency Services found, too, as well.
Yeah. Yes, very closely mirrors it. And these kind of failings that I think were really highlighted, which is that Sonoma was prepared for these smaller scale emergencies, flooding, which they'd experienced a lot before. But with flooding, there's a really specific kind of trigger for how people get evacuated. And so when this firestorm started, they were really lacking in situational awareness and being able to communicate to people where they needed to go, where the fires were starting. And in this day and age where, you know, we get these push notifications on our phone, we're constantly in communication, people had a really much a greater expectation for how they would be notified about the fires and how much notice they would have to flee. And that really didn't happen.
Marisa, there's a lot going on in the legislature, a lot of frustration over insurance company payments of premiums and bills actually are going through the legislature. Update us on all this, can you?
Yeah, so, I mean, one of the things that I'm watching really closely right now has to do with PG&E. Some of the insurance proposals did actually die before they made it to the full, some of them made it to the floor of one house and died, and those were around, protecting consumers more, making it harder to drop them. The big fight that I see moving forward is really around this issue of PG&E liability, utility liability, but in this case, obviously, PG&E is the state's largest utility and the one, that is relevant here. There is a Senator Bill Dodd, who does represent some of these wildfire areas, that critics see as sort of a potential way to at least mute the ability for the public and governments to sue PG&E or potentially for the CPUC to force them to pay out of, their shareholders' pockets for these types of disasters. And I know Mr. Fisk talked about, the San Bruno disaster, which I covered as well. And I think that precedent really does make color the politics of this, because if this were something that had happened and we had never seen.
But so does the Butte County fire, too. Doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that there's a couple of different ones. I think, San Bruno, obviously, in the Bay Area, we're very familiar with. And, it leveled a neighborhood and killed eight people and was so awful. And, PG&E is a felon because of that. They were convicted on six felony accounts. They had to pay millions and millions of dollars in fines. And so, there's a lot of really complicated legal questions here, and I'm going to keep reporting them out. But I think in general, one thing I'm just watching for is how the legislature responds to this, the Senate Bill 1088, because experts I have spoken to who are critical of the utility think that it could really absolve them from some of that financial liability, which then raises the question of who pays, right? And I think that if you are a person that lost your home or whose neighbors, lost their homes, and you're dealing with all of the sort of emotional and financial fallout from something like this, I think it really strikes a deep chord when you hear that you might have to pay through your electricity rates for the damage that a utility caused.
And that's a big battle as well. I mean, an ongoing battle.
Yeah. I mean, so there's a couple of different, I think, areas here where financially that PG&E is at risk. One is around these insurance claims. If indeed, as we heard, every fire is a little different, but in general, the vast majority have not only been found to be PG&E's fault, but the CAL FIRE is recommending that prosecutors review them for potential criminal charges. And so I think the question there is, if that whatever happens there, and we're still waiting for the Tubbs Fire, which was the most destructive. But if you take all of these together, there's an estimated $10 billion in insurance claims. PG&E's liability insurance is $850 million. So that alone is not anywhere near able to cover it. And then there's questions of potential fines at the Public Utilities Commission, state regulators. If this goes to court and there are felony charges, there could be fines around that. You have all these counties. There's over 150 lawsuits from both survivors and then the counties themselves. There are really big questions about the future of this utility and where, the governor is going to stand on them. He's historically been a pretty big defender of PG&E and even of the CPUC, even at times when they were found not to have been doing their job, quite frankly, as regulators. And so I think, we're going to watch this play out in the legislature. We're going to watch it play out in court. And there's a lot on the horizon of uncertainty.
Isn't PG&E, though, trying to essentially get rid of these rules that put wildfire costs onto consumers?
Yeah. So one of the things they've been very vocal about in recent months is basically in California, even if they are found to not have violated any rules. So say take one of these, take the Redwood Fire in Mendocino County. CAL FIRE is saying that their equipment started it, started another fire the next valley over, and that fire was basically blown into Redwood Valley. you know, 9 people died in that. 543 structures were burned. But that case was not actually referred to prosecutors. And so what CAL FIRE is saying, at least as far as we know, because we don't have a ton of details on some of these, but is they're basically saying, look, PG&E started this, but we think they followed all the rules and regulations. Well, currently under legal precedent, they could still be held financially liable even if they had followed all the rules if they caused this. And they're trying to reverse that. In a way, you know, so that's important because, as we said, in 5 of these 16 fires so far, they're not saying state regulators or state investigators are not saying PG&E violated the law. But if the law were to change, then you might have a situation where in no case could they hold the utility liable. And we don't know. I mean, there's a lot of negotiations happening, but it's complicated.
Yeah, it is complicated. Yeah. And what do we know, Suki, about what PG&E is actually going to do as far as equipment upgrades? I mean, at this point, there's a lot of talk about tools and just procedures in general to help, you know, ensure prophylactically against this happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the big change that we've heard about is that they are considering this de-energization prior to a big wind event like that. And they said in some conditions, we are going to look at that. They've in the past said, like, it's really hard to do this. And, you know, then you have to worry about traffic stop signs going dark and, you know, hospitals going dark and all these kind of, you know, secondary ramifications that powering down can have. But I think after this huge of an event that was so deadly and really destroyed so much, they're seeing that, okay, this is really something we have to take seriously. And they're working with CAL FIRE and with the Governor's Office of Emergency Services to kind of come up with plans so that they can do this in a responsible way.
And you know, there's also things around just how both CAL FIRE and PG&E prepare for these. And I think we should give credit. I mean, PG&E is operating, has created the state-of-the-art operations center where they're going to be monitoring weather. They and CAL FIRE say that they're basically expanding their weather stations around the state so that they can not just say, okay, all of Sonoma County is in a red flag warning and has a high potential for fire, but say this specific valley or this, you know,
microclimate.
Yeah, square mile area. And so, you know, I think there's a lot happening to try to prevent the next one. But for the people who lost their friends and family and their homes, it's, I think, too little too late.
And the investigation is ongoing. It's not complete. And as we said, we're going to report certainly on the Tubbs fire when that investigation comes to fruition. But what now, I want to give out the phone number and give listeners an opportunity to join us. I know many of you have questions, comments. We're talking now to Marisa Lagos and Suki Lewis of KQED News and John Fisk, who is an attorney representing a number of counties against PG&E in the litigation. You can join us with your thoughts and any questions or comments by calling in at our toll-free number. That number, 866-733-6786. Again, join us now, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also let us know what's on your mind in light of this CAL FIRE report or any concerns you have or questions or anything you want to bring into the light here by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or, of course, you can also put comments or questions onto our Facebook page. But we do want to get you involved in this, so please feel free to join us. Marisa Lagos, again, is reporter with KQED's California Politics and Government Desk, co-host of KQED's Political Breakdown podcast, and Suki Lewis is a reporter for KQED. They both have been certainly on top of this from the beginning. John Fisk also with us, an attorney representing Mendocino, Napa, and Sonoma in litigation against PG&E. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about CAL FIRE's recently announced findings on the causes of the October wildfires. With us in studio, Marisa Lagos and Suki Lewis. John Fisk is with us by phone. He's the attorney representing the counties of Mendocino, Napa, and Sonoma in litigation against PG&E. And we always get questions and have received them throughout these fires and about underground wires. In fact, I think Peter from Berkeley wants to bring this up. And, of course, in so many countries and so many other places, there are underground wires. And Peter, you want to get a commitment to underground wires? How are you going to do it becomes a media question, especially in light of all the obstacles and all the impediments.
Well, you know, this is, I guess, what I wanted to bring to the table was just this feeling that I've had for a long, long time that there's practical and aesthetic benefits and that the obstacles are worth overcoming. And it seems to me that all these direct linkages to these huge costs in human suffering and finance, individually and collectively, should be enough motivation to just make this commitment and say, okay, we're going to underground all utilities in the state of California. And just on a personal level, I had a lovely walk in yesterday's idyllic weather in a beautiful Berkeley neighborhood, and I noticed, oh, yeah, there's no utility wires in this neighborhood. These affluent houses are, you know, are capable of paying the per, you know, house cost. And then I saw the demarcation line where the wires started again, and it was really ugly. And I just think that we should do the right thing and get the benefits in poor neighborhoods and rich neighborhoods and rural neighborhoods everywhere.
This is always coming through here. Marisa Lagos, yeah. I want to go to you on this. Look, another listener says, many years I've been advocating PG&E bury their high-voltage wires underground, as is a custom in the East Coast, Midwest states, where very high-speed wind is common. And we keep hearing this. On a practical level, it doesn't seem viable, and PG&E doesn't seem responsive to it.
It's very expensive, and I think, you know, this is one of the challenges in living in a state as huge as California. Because
with all the urban interface, in fact.
Right, and I think in some cities, as our caller just mentioned, and I know in parts of San Francisco, I mean, there has been a move to underground wires, and that's something, you know, that I think some local governments have mandated. I think, obviously, in these situations, the bigger problem is in more rural areas with the wildlife, urban interface. I do know that there's one thing, you know, even if we aren't able to underground all the wires in the state, I think there is more talk at this point at the CPUC and among state regulators about there are alternatives. Like, everything doesn't have to go underground. You can have poles that are, where you put the wires in like metal poles, and so they are less likely to break if something falls into them and cause a fire. I think it's fair to say that in a lot of these sort of infrastructure conversations that there's never going to be a one-size-fits-all solution for a state this huge. But I certainly think, you know, I appreciate the sort of spirit of this, and I think we've all had this thought too. But, you know, at a time, again, when I think the utility is facing a sort of existential crisis when it comes to its future and whether or not they can afford to stay in the black, that, and you know, they did, we should mention, declare bankruptcy once before after the energy crisis in around 2000. So
last year, the parent company made $1.6 billion mm-hmm. and actually profit on $17.4 billion in revenue.
Yes. So there is
those figures.
Yeah,
no,
it's true. And I mean, I think that those are the sorts of conversations that are going to be debated, you know, among lawmakers for sure when they look at what kind of legislation should actually be coming down the pike. So we'll see.
We'll see. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, we'll hear from more of our callers. Let me go next to Scott, who joins us from San Francisco. Scott, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you, Michael, and all your KQED staff for your wonderful coverage of this since October. My wife and I had a total loss of our home in the Sulphur Fire up in Lake County, and we read in the paper where that was one of the fires thought to be caused by a failure of PG&E, and we had insurance. We have insurance, but the insurance is not sufficient, and so we don't know. Are we supposed to sue PG&E now, or is the county going to do it? Is there a class action? I mean, what do we do?
Yeah, John Fisk, can you help sort this out? It's important.
Yeah, absolutely. And sir, I'm sorry for your loss. I'll let you know that everybody is underinsured or uninsured.
Especially with the cost of labor, right, John?
Especially when you talk about cost of labor. Yeah. Right now, the cost to rebuild a comparable or exact home is not what is allowed under current insurance policies, and which is a common misperception about the way that insurance works. If someone has $1 million loss, they may only be covered up to $700,000 of insurance, for example, and that $300,000 loss that needs to be made up can only come from your own personal individual lawsuit. So What I would do if I were you is seek out an attorney to represent your interests in order to recover an uninsured or underinsured loss, which won't be covered by insurance. And so the counties and the cities that are suing on their own behalf and are suing on behalf of the taxpayers for purposes of rebuilding their communities. But if you have an individual loss, I would not delay in seeking legal advice as to whether or not a lawsuit is right for you and your family, especially in a circumstance where PG&E has been found liable for a particular fire.
Let me follow that up, if I may, John Fisk, with a couple of questions that are coming in of a legal nature, and I hope we can keep your line okay because it's getting a little shaky. If we have to, we'll get you on a better line. But Olivia tweets, what actual accountability will PG&E be held to? These bad execs need to go, not just pay fines that their insurance companies pay off.
Well, in terms of executive decisions and corporate decisions, that's up to really the shareholders and the boards of the board of directors. What we are here to do on behalf of individual victims and on behalf of municipalities is to hold PG&E accountable under the law where appropriate and necessary. Under Article 1, Section 19 of the California Constitution, the concept that someone's property has been damaged for a public use is a protected property right under the Constitution. And so here we have a situation where PG&E is currently lobbying the legislature to strip fire victims of their constitutional property rights. In addition, they're trying to fight these cases in the litigation. So PG&E is the cause of 16 out of 16 fires. They're fighting it in litigation, and their response also is to fight it at the legislative level to actually strip California constitutional rights from fire victims in and of itself.
But let me go to the heart of this, if I may, and let me get Marisa or Suki to opine on this, because there's always been a lot of public outcry for executives to be tried and convicted, and there hasn't been much action in that area.
No, Marisa? And I mean, you know, it's Jerry Hill, the state senator, who's been very critical and very out front on holding PG&E liable and really pushing for reforms at the CPUC, and I were talking about this last week. I mean, the utility itself is a convicted felon, but they remain as, you know, one of, as you mentioned, very profitable, and I think in some ways one of the most powerful just businesses in general in California. If you look at political giving and lobbying and where there has been success at, you know, going back at them, it's almost as if those felony convictions had really little to no effect.
And Suki, let me go to you on this. City of Santa Rosa, Gary writes, never should have allowed homes to be built in the path of wildland fires. Why aren't the city and developers being blamed for the loss of those homes?
Well, I think especially as we kind of look at rebuilding, that is a big question. You know, humans, we cause fires.
About 80%.
Yes. So the more we build in these wildland places, the more fires we end up starting there. And it really raises questions about, like, what should be the laws about how we build there, you know, if there should be restrictions around this. But again, Coffee Park is not in a wildland area. Like, it is a suburban subdivision. You know, the Kmart burned down, as I like to say. If you want defensible space, you can't get much better than a Kmart parking lot, and yet it burned to the ground. And so this was really unprecedented. And so I do think that these, you know, questions about development, how we rebuild and where we build, and, you know, also greater awareness on the part of homeowners and human beings, all of us, about how we can be more responsible in our relationship to the environment we live in and not start them.
But that is something that PG&E is arguing. I mean, they have filed claims with Sonoma and I believe Napa as well. Definitely in Sonoma, essentially saying, hey, wait, this is the county and city's fault for letting this this building happen. And I mean, we thought about this a lot during our months and months of reporting and listening to these just horrific 911 calls from people in the path of this and how, you know, hard it is. We have a very we have a culture of sort of letting people do what they want with their property. And once you have bought something, it is very hard for counties and governments to come in and tell you, hey, no, you shouldn't be living there.
We're going to go to more of your calls. Let me go next to John. John, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael and guests. Thank you for this program. I have a comment and a question. My comment is this, that if some of these executives, corporate executives, such as with PG&E.
I'm sorry, what happened to the caller?
Gross negligence. I would give up all the fines. Let the taxpayer pay the fines, but put the corporate executives in jail where they are criminally negligent. My question is this. As I understand it, the CPUC has had a very chummy relationship with PG&E, which contributed to the disaster killing 8 people in the San Bruno gas line explosion. My question to your guests is that chummy relationship still ongoing, and did it play any role in the negligence PG&E is being accused of this time?
Marisa, I'm going to go to you on this because you talked to us about San Bruno back
in
the day.
Yeah, and I've covered this. And you know, I think I mentioned before, like, one thing that's really interested me is watching how much our governor, you know, who has been out there and critical of other sort of organizations and maybe, you know, people might not expect, but he was very close with the former head of the PUC, Michael Peavy, who actually has been investigated for some of that chumminess. I mean, I think the bottom line is here that
chumminess could be a euphemism, can't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, there was out of that disaster, we saw emails about, you know, bottles of wine being shared and sort of like relationship that went beyond like, hey, we have a friendly relationship because we have to work together, in a sense that really the deck was stacked against consumers at the PUC. There has been a change of leadership. PV did step down. Michael Picker, the head now. You know, I think what he would say is that they have a responsibility to balance both what, you know, is right for consumers in terms of, you know, what we're talking about, but also the sort of health and viability of the utilities that give us all light and gas and all the things we need. So I think what I would say is there have been improvements both inside the PUC and I think in general, to some extent at PG&E, but I think it's our responsibility as the public and definitely the press to keep an eye on that and really to see how this plays out, because most of what we know about those things came out as a result of the litigation and the investigations because of the San Bruno tragedy.
Let me bring more callers aboard and let me thank John for his call. And let me go next to you, Andrew. Thank you for waiting. You're on with us. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's my first time calling in. I just have a really quick question. We have all this talk about high power transmission lines and underground bearing, and everything seems like super extreme. And I'm just wondering, it seems to me like investing in more like microgrids, using renewables or types of energy, and making, you know, that kind of more of the focus reduces the need for these transmission lines, which also kind of then reduces the need to transmit power over them, and also the places receiving that power during an outage, like for instance during a windstorm. And I'm just wondering, you know, what's PG&E's role in all that? What's, as a private organization, you know, how can we as consumers and as, you know, voters kind of try to really kind of push that agenda and become, you know, turn these communities into more energy producers rather than consumers?
Andrew, I thank you for the call. Sugi, what can you tell us about those microgrids?
Well, I'm not a microgrid expert, but I can tell you. That's Lisa, who's out with our baby. but I can tell you that, you know, if we are looking at a potential future where PG&E could be broken up, like, this is the future that we would get, you know, these, you know, the kind of more community-based electricity programs and these microgrids and stuff like that. So it may be a future that we have in store for us anyway. And, you know, I think it would be great to have an expert on that to come in and explore that further.
Well, I think one thing that's important, though, to note is that even with, you know, the explosion in recent years of community choice aggregation options, so where places where it's sort of public power light, where we have an option now rolling out in San Francisco, Marin has long had this, where the government is setting the rates and buying the electricity on the wholesale market, we're still using PG&E infrastructure. And like, to change that would either mean, you know, buying that infrastructure from the utility or creating a whole new one, which I don't think is, like, you know, even I think that's completely prohibitive. So whatever is to happen with where we get our electricity and who we pay for it, the infrastructure we would have to invest in to improve it.
Well, here's Jeffrey, who says centralized power distribution should soon be obsolete. Undergrounding might cost as much as solar or Powerwall installations. And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me thank Andrew for his call, and let me get next to Jim in Pacifica. Jim, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on. I want to say it's reprehensible that PG&E would blame climate change, but I wouldn't like to see a witch hunt on PG&E, because I think there's a lot of blame to go around for a lot of different things. That scientific papers show that fire season is three times longer due to human ignitions than natural fires. I was an ecologist, and I know that fire season, we knew that suppression of fires, it was building fuel loads that was going to make us pay down the road. So a lot of communities have a responsibility for making sure people have the right kind of conditions to deal with these fires. And it's not just a Kmart, like, parking lot. A lot of this fire was spread by embers that were blowing through the wind and catching people's eaves. And you could do simple things like making sure their eaves are protected. Governor Brown was blaming climate change. Some of the climate scientists are blaming climate change for these fires. And those kind of suggestions are making people not analyze what the real causes of these deadly fires are.
Yeah, I thank you for that call. And let me go to John Fisk on this, because John Fisk, I believe you've made some statements about, well, you did earlier in this program, too, about the role of climate change. But it certainly harkens back to what Senator Jerry Hill from San Mateo has said about this being the new norm. And that's pretty much what we're hearing from PG&E.
Well, let's be very, very clear about what starts and causes utility-caused wildfires. It's not land use, it's not development, it's not the PUC, it's not the legislature, it's not eaves. The thing that causes utility-caused wildfire is poor utility management, poor vegetation management, poor policies with regards to high winds, powering down, and de-energizing lines when they have either fallen or broken off. So there, in a disaster like this, it is very common for the public and for the legislature to look at a bunch of different ways in which we can solve the problem. But as an attorney who deals in fact and in law, and as I'm required to under the court, I have to constantly remind folks that what causes these fires to begin with is poor vegetation management. And when Cal Fire, an independent organization, has found that in 11 of the 16 fires, they were per se negligent for violation of law, that's what we need to look at to prevent future fires. That's where we need to focus our energy, is in fire prevention at the management level. This is a multi-billion dollar company that has a 15 million customer monopoly. It has been given incredible powers by the state of California. It has eminent domain power, and it has a guaranteed profit. Last year, they did $1.66 billion in profit. They've done, on average, over the last 10 years, $1.1 billion in net profit. What we are suggesting is that why don't they take some of that billion-dollar net profit and put it towards vegetation management, high wind policies, and recloser or de-energizing policies to prevent the fires to begin with.
But there are other facts that have to be, I think, looked at. And I wonder what you say about the fact that, and PG&E is coming out pretty much blazing with these facts about the long drought that we went through and the extreme heat, not to mention 129 million dead trees that they keep alluding to. I mean, isn't that all part of the equation we're talking about?
It's because of those factors. It's because of that environment. It's because of that foreseeable predictability of the conditions that PG&E should be more cautious. They should put more money towards vegetation management, and they should be extra careful, because we're talking about 44 lives lost and over 6,000 families who lost their homes. It's because of those other facts that should be considered, or other factors, that we need to hold PG&E accountable to the standard to prevent the fires to begin with.
Again, we're talking with John Fisk, attorney who represents the counties of Mendocino, Napa, and Sonoma in litigation against PG&E. And let me go to more of your calls. We go to Los Gatos and welcome Jim. Jim, you're on. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, I have a comment that's maybe in the form of a question. I wonder, with all the talk about the things that PG&E did not do, if indeed PG&E would take financially costly steps to reduce risk, if the rate base and the ratepayers would be interested in paying additional for electricity. PG&E is a rate of return-based entity, and so there's no free lunch here, and I think we're all speaking as if these things would all come out of the hide of the company, but the company is regulated based on rate of return.
Yeah, Marisa Lagos.
I mean, it's a good point, but I will note that I think it depends on what you're talking about. So one of the things that was found in San Bruno was that they had taken money that they had told regulators they were using to upkeep their gas lines and had sort of redirected it. And so, I think the question becomes, yes, moving forward, we need to look at the full picture and who needs to pay for what. But if you're looking backward and finding that the utility didn't adequately, say in this case, trim its vegetation or upkeep its lines, even though they told state and federal regulators they were spending the money on that, then what's the outcome and who pays for that? And that's what we saw in San Bruno. So this isn't totally hypothetical.
Let me thank the caller. Read a couple comments here. Noah writes, I'm not looking forward to my bill going up when the PUC blesses PG&E's passing on the cost of the fire. And R asks, is it time to seize control of PG&E until better approaches are deployed? Suki, could the state take over and impose actual changes on PG&E here?
I'll take that. I think it would take legislation. Most of this regulation in terms of giving the CPUC the power is enshrined in law. But that's something that Jerry Hill, the state senator, told me as recently as Friday that he sees as still on the table is the potential to at least move to break them up. Now, whether the political will be there for that, I am sort of wary. I mean, again, I kind of alluded to this earlier, but PG&E is one of the biggest spenders around politics, both in lobbying and in supporting both election campaigns, but also they've always really taken a deep advantage of the law that allows private entities to give on behalf of politicians to philanthropic causes. So if you look at, locally, the San Francisco mayor, Jerry Brown, when he was as governor and mayor, they're often writing checks to community groups on behalf of politicians. It's called behested payments. And so, they have a lot of friends.
And we have a caller joining us from Sausalito who wants to tell us what he has noted about San Diego Gas and Electric. Go ahead, Arthur. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. I noticed San Diego Gas and Electric has started this policy already. The reclosers that they are using are now using consume a lot less, will release a lot less energy as the recloser attempts to remake the circuit after a short circuit, which would contribute less to fire. And we don't hear about this up here. Perhaps we should. And
we just did, thanks to you, Arthur.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. In fact, a number of callers are talking about the way things are done in other places, and the next caller is as well, and that's Arvalon from Alameda. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to see if the contributors may be able to help me understand a little bit better. The other utility company cases, which may be similar as far as liability, be it towards the executives within the company or the diligence that's being questioned in regard to PG&E right now in this light of new events that have happened in the fires. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I didn't totally understand that question. I'm sorry.
Well, I think that there's actually a relation between the last two callers, which is this SDG&E question about reclosers and how they are held financially responsible. So essentially, SDG&E has been a lot more aggressive about this idea of shutting down power lines proactively and keeping them shut off during disasters. And that was the direct result of a fire down there, a deadly fire, in which the PUC did ultimately, after a lot of appeals and fighting over it, almost 10 years later, say PG&E cannot pass on over $300 million in costs related to those fires to consumers, and that part of the reason for that was this idea that they should have been more proactive in closing down the line. So there is some precedent for the PUC saying, no, you can't pass this on. And again, I think, you know, not to be a broken record, but I think we have to just keep in mind that we're talking about like six different things here. We're talking about insurance claims. We're talking about lawsuits. We're talking about PUC fines and all the many myriad of issues. All of those could end up in court.
Well, here's a listener, Mary Lee, and maybe we ought to go to attorney on this, John Fisk. We got very little time left, but she wants to know, she says, PG&E is spending millions to advertise on television to make themselves look good. This irks me, and I wish the money went to fire victims or programs for the future. Can the advertising be stopped since it's a public utility and us ratepayers are paying for it one way or another?
Well, I'm not sure if it can be stopped from a legal perspective, but it certainly is indicative of how much money that PG&E really does have. And we agree that nothing speaks louder than actions. So rather than running television advertisements, we think it might be wise for PG&E to look inward into its vegetation management policies and to also look inward to figure out how they're going to compensate the thousands of victims whose lives have been totally devastated and turned upside down due to PG&E's negligence.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to conclude. John Fisk, thank you for being with us. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Suki Lewis.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you, Marisa Lagos.
My pleasure.
And thank you, our listeners. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat of 10 to 11 in the evening. And we remind you that you can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Tomorrow on Forum, we're going to talk with a local author who has written about his siege of mental illness with his wife. It's quite a poignant and remarkable story. In the opening hour, we'll talk about North Korea and what's going to happen in Singapore. Thanks for being here for this program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.